and Empire State South. There's probably loud noises of ice being thrown around behind me. It's okay, it's all clean. Next to me is an amazing writer and journalist, who's Kim Severson. And Kim is a writer for the New York Times. Kim, tell me what you do for the Times. Because it changed recently.
Thanks for asking. And here we are in the South, which and I have to say, at Empire State South.
But
which
you're not
is,
the South writer now. There's another person.
Right. I came down here from New York City to be the bureau chief for the national desk. Had written about food for a long time and was kind of interested in a change and happy to get out of New York for a minute and thought, oh, I'll try Atlanta. Why not? And then here I am 8 years later, however long it's been. And now I did that for about 4 years and I did, you know, hurricanes and shootings and politics and all the things you do on the national desk. And about 4 years ago, my boss, Sam Sifton, and the Times decided to double down on cooking and launch our cooking app and get more serious about the cooking piece of what we do. And wanted me to come back to the food section and do kind of national food corresponding, which basically means that I go around the country and try to pick up stories, whether they're, going down to Puerto Rico to hang out with Jose Andres while he was cooking, or going to a little farm in Indiana where the cheesemaker is about to lose her farm, you know, all those sorts of things. So I just sort of range around.
So everything now is in relation to food in some way?
Yep. So I am a food correspondent, although occasionally when there's, you know, some big, terrible thing, I might get pulled in to help out a little bit.
Because of regional connection.
Yeah, and just because all hands on
but
deck.
But Sam Sifton, runs the Sifty, is a very bright man. And they, in an age where newspapers are supposed to make no money anymore, the New York Times has really successfully monetized the food section.
Food and crosswords are saving the day.
That's because I subscribe to both.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I do the Sudoku. I do the easy and the medium, I'll tell you.
Because look at the big brain on you, Hugh Atchison.
I know.
I can't do the heart.
I can't. The brain is not that big to do the heart. And I can do the Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday crossword. And then I have to wait till Sunday and do the big one very slowly.
Okay.
But it is interesting to me that so many aspects of food media tried to monetize. I mean, Serious Eats was a really interesting concept.
Ed took it ahead of his time.
So seriously, and Kenji was so amazing in writing thoroughly researched recipes that made sense and were super researched, but they just could never monetize to the degree. So it lends me to like this gifted arsenal of people at the Times, like Melissa Clark and Sam Sifton, and you guys have other national food correspondents like John T. Edge. And then Brett Anderson recently came on board.
Yeah, Brett's on. Our brother Brett's going to be with us for a year or so, maybe more, if we can entice him. That was a big
Brett is
score
a wonderful
for us.
Human.
Yeah.
With the craziest laugh
truly.
In the world.
Truly. Giggles like a schoolgirl.
Oh, he guffaws.
Yes,
I think
he's
guffaws.
Great.
But it is really interesting to see that success is there. And it opens up the allowance to give you a budget and the Times a budget to have you do stories.
Thank God your bar crew is working. Well, look at
they are really working.
Give that young man a raise who just dumped that ice in there.
Really,
good for them.
They're really loud.
Well, I'll tell you, the thing the we kind of look at ourselves, and I think culture to a degree, the culture sections, the food section, crosswords, we sort of look at it like we're at war now, right? So we are back here rolling bandages and growing the victory garden. So our frontline reporters like Maggie Haberman can be in there doing the incredibly hard work of covering the government right now and covering all of these sort of horrible world events. So we really like to sort of see our role as very essential. And if we're here making money for the paper, that's a great thing. And lo and behold, many people are really, really want to learn how to cook and they want to be part of a cooking community. So we have this cooking app. And the other thing, this is great, the ice. I'm making a very important point about the state of journalism.
I'm about to have to yell at somebody for the first time.
So journalism really matters.
Hold on. We'll edit this out. Yes. Brad, can you get them to shut up with the ice? Okay.
So the thing that's behind the cooking app that matters that people don't see is you do have Melissa and you have Sam's kind of vision of what makes a good story. It's Samin writing for us, you know, and putting all these great recipes in our database. But Sam did the smart thing, and the paper had the resources to hire all these great young digital people who understood how to make the app work. Like, you know, is this comfortable for somebody to look up the recipe? Should the recipe scroll this way? Should it scroll that way?
Where are you standing in the kitchen? All the time? I mean, yeah. Is it readable while you're at the stove?
Should they be side by side? How, you know, and really good editors who make sure that, you know, we test and double test and make sure that the teaspoons all match the whatever. So he got all these young digital people who maybe didn't know a lot about cooking, but as you know, the kids today love the food, and they're great, and they're really interested in food. So he kind of made these 10 or 12 people designing our app part of our food team. And as you know, food, whenever you're around food, it makes family, right? So with these great kids figuring out the app, and I call them kids because I'm an old lady, and that's fine. You know, they're working
kids
on the app.
Days.
And Sam's like, oh, this is Kim Severson. She just came back from wherever. This is Melissa Clark, and she's going to put together the Instant Pot guide. And they'd meet us, and we'd meet them and talk about things. And so that kind of community build up, so people would want to come back and use the app. And then we also have a really good service. So you have people who can write in and say, I'm outraged. I substituted cornstarch for the flour and my recipe didn't work. And so then people gently, instead of saying,
that's because you're a moron. And
instead of saying, I'm sorry, we're going to be forced to cancel your subscription. You know, we talk to them and there's like this crazy big Facebook page that like, you know, so there's all these points in which you have to work for every subscriber you have and care about them. And I think some of the early digitization of food sites, while they had great material, that just on the ground customer service piece, they didn't have the resources to do it, you know?
Yeah, but that's all about resources to do it. It really is.
That's why.
And and that's why we see demise of some of those great websites and just, they didn't have the cash.
Can we speak about one other website or food digitization thing that I think is going really well? Is I have lately been really impressed with how they're doing things at Bon Appetit, only because I don't know if you all watch their videos at all, their YouTube, but that whole like turning their test kitchen into these little, I watched like 10 minutes. I watched, what's his name, trying to recreate Jamie Oliver's Impossible Burger, or no, not Impossible, his.
What is his name?
Chris, the guy who's the taste guy. He's like.
He's great.
Super taster. I was like, I don't have 10 minutes to do anything in my day. And I was like, I was into it. So that's like genius,
well,
right?
It's also that test kitchen's like on the 46th story of the, the. Trade,
it's a beautiful test kitchen
building at WTC. It's a stunning test kitchen.
Right.
But they do a great job at that magazine. They've really, really.
They sort of survived the dark times, I think, and are coming out the other side.
I mean, the loss of Gourmet was terribly sad in a lot of ways in food media, but you could see it coming. And they made their choice, and they chose Bon App. And Bon App's done really well with food photography. And not making it look, I think they became very conscious not making it too precious. Because I think there was a move towards everything looking like it was on a Brooklyn table. And they're kind
was
of fought against that.
Didn't Savour start the whole, like, was it Chris, started the whole scatter the food across the table look? That was the Savour and shoot from the top look?
Yep.
That was, I remember those days.
Those days. So I'm looking at a couple of your recent articles. Now, let me first say this. How did you get knighted with the position of writing every culinary obituary that ever happens?
I know.
Is that on your CV? I write about dead people?
I meet people, I'm like, be nice to me. I may be writing your obituary. I like to say I'm putting the bitch back in obituary, Hugh. That's
my thing.
But
they're beautifully written. And the one I'm really looking at right now is Leah Chase, who at 96 passed away recently, and who was just the most amazing most amazing force of culinary wisdom in New Orleans, and meant so much to that city and so much to fried chicken and the world of Southern food as we know it. But this is a beautiful, but how do you write an obituary? I mean, other than just doing a biography of somebody, what are you looking to evoke? Like, because you got to get to something. There's something in an obituary. The reasoning as to why it's being written. What's the story?
I mean, obituaries are such a great form of journalism, and they're their own craft. It's sort of like being able to write a great baseball story. You know, it's a craft unto itself. And I certainly am not one of the great obituary writers of the world, and there are people who are. But I and this one I was very glad they put on the front page because I think that speaks to it. But you know a lot about the person, and I have reported on a lot of these people that have been reporting on food for 100 years, and so I understood her place in the culinary firmament, right? And, you know, you have to write it with a sense of scope and a sense of heft. And the other thing that's great about obituaries is you get to kind of loosen up a little, and you're like, I'm saying this is true. This is this person's life. This is what they meant. It's not as constrictive as a traditional news story. And there's a, and then you, there's a certain kind of honor that comes with it. So you, you certainly don't want to just have it be flowery and gushy, because nobody wants to read that. Trust me, that's kind of boring. So you definitely have to put in the warts and all. But you can do it in a way that, you know, the person just died. This isn't, you know, we're not trying to take down a president or anything. You're just trying to reflect a life. So I just sort of think about that. It allows you to storytell, you know.
But a
it's
really
great.
Well-written obituary, which this is, can be read by somebody who has no idea who Leah Chase is.
And you learn history.
Informed of something.
Right, right.
And beautiful and informed of their pertinence to it. But I'll read the last paragraph because it's beautifully done. It says, Mrs. Chase believed in corporal punishment, opposed abortion, and believed women should dress modestly. But she was always a champion of women, especially young women, coming up in the kitchens of America's restaurants. Her frequent advice to them was, you have to look like a girl, act like a lady, think like a man, and work like a dog. And that is so Leah Chase, because
yeah,
I knew
exactly.
Leah Chase. And
yeah.
She was that. And,
right.
But she was such a supporter. But she has very strict rules.
Yeah.
On
yeah,
decorum.
She was old school. And,
she was old school.
And, you know, coming up as she did in the times that she did, being African-American and in a time when, you know, she had that same sense of, it's the same reason that the early civil rights protesters would always dress well, show up, be well-behaved. There was a sense that if we are... you know, if we are respectful of ourselves and our cause, then other people will be respectful of it, too.
That'll magnetically attract other,
and
at least
credence.
And she was
also a hardcore Catholic like her. The stuff she did for Dookie. She used to tell me stories like her husband, Dookie, she was going to be a good wife. She would take his shoes off when he came home at the end of the day. She'd probably worked harder than he had. Rub his feet, get him a drink. Like, that was old school, you know, male-female marriage roles. And, you know, she's like, it's, you know, it's what you did. And she, but she at the same time didn't take any crap from anybody. I guess we're on a podcast. I could say shit and not
you
worry.
Can say shit. You can say whatever.
Hell
you want.
Hell yeah. So, you know, it's, I think obituaries, when you read them, ideally you learn something about history and you learn something about culture, even if you have no idea. You know, you could read about the person who invented the slinky and you'd like learn
but
amazing
that's
things.
Funny, because I love, actually, you're totally right that, I mean, it's a historical narrative. Of, you can learn a lot in obituary. I mean, reading obituaries about people who passed away or who were World War II vets and they're passing away recently. And it's just about how they, you know, how you encapsulate their war life with their life after that. It's
right.
just really
And the history of what was happening when they were alive and at their peak, you know. And then it allow it's just a great way to read about history without it feeling like history, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's one perspective. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. This is another beautiful, this is a really interesting article because I think we know this is On the Trail of Tupelo Honey, Liquid Gold from the Swamps.
Are you a Tupelo Honey fan? Do you like Tupelo?
I find it very powerful.
I had never understood Tupelo.
I mean, I understood a lot better after this article.
Yeah.
I had a good tacit understanding of it. I never really loved it all that much.
Yeah.
That I find it's very...
specific.
To me, it's like chestnut honey.
Yeah, not quite as heavy, though, I think.
No.
I mean, it's more vegetal, for sure,
yeah.
The honey. I'm not, you know, I didn't love honey. Ruth Reichel, by the way, side note, famously, the one food she hates is honey. Just, there's your, you know, dinner party trivia tip for listeners. She just
that
hates
really surprises
honey.
Me.
She hates honey. Has always hated honey.
Does she have a short... form Japanese style poem about
she
eating?
Should honey
because
terrible
do you
I hate it yeah
her,
the deer's Ryan. Here yeah. And buns and butter yeah whatever yeah the haiku
sweaty
of
windows
yes
brioche baking
New York
wet puddle on floor
deer. Yeah
it's like what okay where are we going
God bless her. But yeah so I didn't know a lot about it but I ran into this guy who was like told me the guy who sells honey here in Atlanta at the farmer's market this Tupelo and he's a great guy and was talking to him. He's got 150 hives around Atlanta. So I was sort of interested in that. And then he's like, oh, I got to go down with my Tupelo guy. And I'm like, what is the deal with Tupelo? And I had heard from someone else that the hurricanes had really taken out a lot of the Tupelo hives. And that also...
Did it take out the hives or take out the trees?
Took out both, the trees and the hives.
Okay.
It stripped a lot of the trees, but it really blew their hives out. And also, there was an issue with the water flow down there, and so they were already losing trees because Swamp was drying up. So there were all these. So I was kind of like, oh, man. So I finally talked him into taking me down with this honey, this Tupelo guy. These guys are secretive, like you can't believe, because they know where their little Tupelo groves are, and they don't want anybody else down there. And you can get a lot of, you know, you get a lot of money for the Tupelo honey.
It's kind of like a trout hole. Right. You don't tell anybody your fishing hole.
So I finally talked him into letting me come and hang out with them. And I'm telling you, I really have never tasted anything like when he pulled it out of the hive.
So let's explain to people what exactly is Tupelo honey.
Okay. So Tupelos are trees that grow in swamps in a really specific, the white Tupelo that this honey comes from a really specific part of South Georgia and North Florida. So there's the swamps down there, and there's these trees. That's the only place in the country they grow. There are black Tupelos that grow up in Mississippi. Thus, you have Tupelo, Mississippi, but those are not, the honeybees don't like those to make honey from. So these white Tupelos only grow in this one specific spot. And they grow these flowers. They're kind of tall and sort of gnarly trees that grow up, and they grow these white flowers that look like pom-poms, kind of whitish green. And they are there for about 2 weeks on a good season, and the bees are amazing. So they know exactly. Listen to me, bees are amazing.
Bees
here.
Are amazing.
Yeah, and so the bees at the right time, they know they're like, okay, these guys are all the nectar's here. Let's go, guys. And so they'll wait until it's just right, and then all the bees, if you have hives down there in the swamp, will just go up and get the Tupelo for 2 weeks until they're done, and then once that's done, they'll move on to gallberry or other things because the bees are like, okay, we're done here. So for these
how do they sequester then and get the beehives? Like, how do they know it's all Tupelo at that point?
Right. So generally, the bees, they know the bees well enough to know they will go for what's perfectly blooming at that moment, and so the bees do the work. So the bees, so they'll know that it's happening, and they'll just gather it. Like the bees will come back and they'll be checking their hives, and they'll just get full of honey. And Tupelo itself has almost a greenish tint to it. Looks real specific. Now, this story, it was a big debate over whether Georgia or Florida had the purest. And they send the honey out
to a testing facility.
And you can tell by the amount of pollen that's in them. Like, is it 56? Is it 96%? So you can get a lot of fake Tupelo out there. Generally, it's there's no law that says if we label something Tupelo and it's not. But there are... You know, like everything else, you have to have a good provider, and you have to know who you're buying it from. And, you know, these guys down south, and they'll put it in big 55-gallon drums.
But, I mean, it's like the most expensive honey there is.
It is expensive, although I think there's a honey in Turkey that's more expensive than Tupelo honey. But it's just all these guys down in these swamps who figured it out, and they're like, all right, they're going to buy a lot of, you know, because it's so hard to get.
Yeah.
Right? But then what will happen is as the Tupelo's bloom starts to fade, the bees, gallberry is another thing that goes right after Tupelo. This soursop up in the Appalachia Mountains is a similar sort of rare honey that is got a little different texture to me. But it's amazing that it even works. I'm like, how do you even know they're not mixing pollen from everything else? And these guys, if they put them in a Tupelo grove, that's all the bees are going to go for. And you have to monitor every day and make sure that it doesn't start to turn. And these guys watch the blossoms. And
is the bee population there, is it growing? Is it coming back? Or is it still
in South Georgia? There's a lot. They're doing a really good job, I think. And there's a lot more in South Georgia than there is in Florida right now. I think that they're coming back. A lot of these guys move their bees around, which I didn't understand. So they'll take their beehives in, let them work for a couple of weeks, and then they'll, like this one fellow I wrote about, then he puts his bees on a truck and trucks them up to Maine to pollinate the blueberry fields in Maine. I'm like, how do the bees survive that? And he's got like a GPS tracker, and he has his drivers. They can't stop, you know, or if they stop, they have to be in a cool place. He's got a water down that, like, he watches like where his trucks go, and if they at all gets, like, if they get stuck in traffic, he gets all nervous, and he's like, "You've got to get off the road and take the bees." Like, it's a whole thing, moving
like
the bees up and
truck.
Down.
You can't really stop.
Yeah,
you get stuck in traffic.
But
you
I love this honey, shipment. And I didn't find it as strong as you find. I mean, I still have a couple of mason
How
jars
much is
of it.
It.
I think it was like $25 a pound you can buy it for, depending on where you get it. They sell it if you go down to one of the festivals, maybe it'll be $11 or $12 for.
Why did Van Morrison call that song Tupelo Honey?
Sweet as Tupelo Honey. I only made one subtle reference to it.
Tupelo Honey is not even that well known.
Or sweet.
So how did Van Morrison know about it in the 60s?
Exactly. Maybe because of Mississippi. I don't know.
He's a master. A culinary master.
Tupelo Honey is so nice to say. Tupelo honey. I don't know how I know. I'm only going to allow to use one reference to that song. It's certainly not going to be the lead because that would just be cheese ass.
Who's your direct editor with these things?
So I just put it subtly down below, and I didn't even mention the song, and people kind of are like, why didn't you mention it? But I say in one parenthetical, I say it may not unlike the song you're
it's a really long article though.
I'm sorry, because you know what they pay me. They don't even pay me by the word.
They don't pay you by the word.
No, they don't. But I just made a mention of like this, it may be the song that's going through your head right now because everybody knows it. And then I had people calling me up saying, how could you not mention Tupelo Honey? And I said, it's in there.
I did.
So anyway, Sifton, Patrick Farrell, who's kind of the workhorse editor of the section, great guy, really great guy, old Metro editor and a really he's the guy you can sit and argue word usage with and punctuation. He's that kind of editor and he's fun, really fun. It's like when I turn in a story and we get on the phone together, it's a great hour or two where we sit talking over the story. And he's a very deft and experienced editor. Sifton will come in sometimes if he's not around, or Sifton sort of top notes everything. So I'll be like, I'm thinking about this story, and we'll kick around like the concept for it. Is this a story now? Like Sifton will run news stories a little bit more. It'll be like we just wrote about the Madison Park guys, Madison Park guys breaking up, and
that was a really well done.
We had that thing on the fish on the line for a long time, and I talked to them back in April, and they're like, "No, we think we're going to work it out. Just can you hold off?" And
this is the story of 11 Madison Park, which is arguably these days probably the most important restaurant in the United States. It's been number one on the San Pellegrino 50 best list. It's Will Gadara runs the front of the house, and Daniel Hume runs the kitchen and is the chef. And they co-owned it, and along with a lot of other projects that they had on the go. And they recently kind of had a business divorce. And Kim wrote a really illustrative article about it, and really interesting. So what did you distill down to? Why did they break up?
Well, you know, no one really knows the truth of two people. They didn't get along for a long time. I mean, they butted heads, and people will tell you that. I think they both shared a vision. One theory is that, you know, Will got with Christina Tozzi and married, and kind of, I think, for a long time, the restaurant was his spouse, you know? Yeah. And also, Daniel was going through he's had ups and downs in his relationships, now famously dating Lorene Jobs, Steve Jobs' wife.
I didn't know that.
The late Steve Jobs' wife. And they've been dating since maybe, this is gossipy now, January.
Nobody listens to this anyhow. Can we find?
So I think ultimately they wanted to go in different directions. I think Will had some ideas about what he's into hospitality, right? And I think Daniel.
Make it nice.
I think Daniel kind of wants to be seen as a sort of artist the way that Chang is, or Rene Renzeppi is. And I think there was a clash between that idea of just being a great restaurant and being about service and an artistic vision as a chef. And these two guys wanted those two different things. So I think that maybe be part of the clash there of what they wanted. You know, Will wants to, you know, he's got the dream weaver. He's all about the Danny Meyer style of service, handpicked by Danny Meyer to make it happen. And I think then once Christina came in and Daniel, you know, these two men who gave their entire lives to this restaurant for 10 or 12 years.
They found other loves. They started
dating other people.
But it's
totally understandable. I don't think it's scandalous in any way people were upset about is they feel like they portrayed themselves as this great bromance and there was a lot of trouble behind the scenes.
I think the people were just reading into that.
I hate the people.
And because of
like
celebrity,
people.
It's like, yeah. But that's interesting. But, you know, why is that news? Why is America interested in that?
Why
now?
They are breaking up, you mean? Or why?
Why is America interested in, like, America would have not been interested in a breakup
1999.
Of
Wolfgang Puck and his general manager. Well, what happened is in the last 20 years, I can remember in the late 90s when then the Gen Xers, it was a young generation, was the first time that they were spending more money of it, more of their disposable income at restaurants than any other form of entertainment. And that was like a big news. I remember writing that story in the San Francisco Chronicle. It was a phenomenal shift. So people would maybe grab a bite before they would go to a concert or a movie or something else. Restaurants became the thing people would go to. That was their entertainment, right? That became what they would spend their, that was their event for the night. So we have this whole generation of people that grew up in, you know, all the celebrity chef stuff, all of the, you know, food now, as I say all the time, is our cultural currency. And it's sort of like the way film was in the 70s. That's how we worked out our shit with all the Scorsese films and the changing sexual mores and all of that was through film. And in the same way, it was sort of jazz in the 20s was kind of reflected the thing where we worked out a lot of our stuff. So food comes along. We've got a digital revolution happening. We need some low-stakes shit to start to practice to become technological so we can send pictures of food to each other. We can, you know, celebrity
food
gossip.
Food porn is born.
Yeah, well, food porn and celebrity gossip just shot up once because we needed some low-stakes stuff to start to learn technology as a culture, I think, right? Now we're getting much more advanced in all that in politics and, you know, we see how technology is affecting big things. But in the beginning, so all that happened when people started Celebrity Chef, Food Network, technology, we needed low stakes fodder, food porn, all of that started happening. And then I also think you had a generation, and you know this very well because your work you do with teaching kids to cook. So we had two working moms or two working parents, right? So there's a generation of kids who didn't know how to cook because they were the latch and McDonald's in the 70s. Moms are working.
Latchkey kids.
Kids are not. And so you don't have moms teaching kids to cook. So that's why you see someone like Rachel Ray who's able to come in with a 30-minute meal and essentially have to reteach an entire generation to cook. And you know this. You are.
And feeds dogs a lot of dog food.
Well, she does, man. She's making some bank off that
food. I think she's making some money off the dog food. Yeah. I got
to
be honest.
Although she gives, I have to say, she gives a heck of a lot of that dog food money away to dog food, to pet things.
Oh, I know. All the celebrity people in the culinary world who I choose to make fun of and demonize, they're actually kind of all wonderfully empathetic and compassionate, interesting humans.
And the ones that aren't,
some of them aren't
really
like
stick
Guy
out.
Guy Fieri I make fun of all the time. Yeah. And Guy's actually a really beautiful soul.
And means well. Means so well. He really does.
The problem I have with Guy is still like, this is
donkey sauce. That's all you have to say.
Life off of being on a show where you weren't supposed to be able to cook well,
right?
Like amateur chef type thing, and parlayed it into this monstrous career. And I'm still like,
how did he do that? Yeah, so. I don't know. It's the sunglasses. I don't know. But guys, you know, and he also, there's a certain segment of the male population that just like relates to him like nothing else.
Nuts.
It's crazy. I mean, because
there are a lot of people with truck nuts.
Listen,
a lot of people don't,
I will
really
say, he came to the New York Times to do an interview
had
with
truck
us.
Nuts on his truck
he
too.
Did he? The guy who just built our new fence had truck nuts, and I just trying to explain that to my daughter. She's like, "What are those?" And I'm like, "I don't know, honey. It's something to help tow something."
It's
is
an
what
ode to a testicular sack hanging from the back of a truck. Why don't you get
it? Right. Go read your books. But anyway, so when we walked Guy through the Times newsroom, there were these like nerdy 40s, 50-something editors who were just like, oh, that's God. And so now I see where that comes from.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So anyway, getting back to your point of why we care about Daniel Hume and Will breaking up. So, you know, culture now, food is our cultural currency. And here you have the two chefs at the, you know, top of their game. It's like, you know, LeBron James or something. It's like these are the guys. So if they were in some kind of split up.
Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of like that. I think. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, I think it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, it's such the apex of dining and that restaurant. I would say that equally, I think they're both extraordinarily important to the success of that restaurant. And that's rare.
Right.
And that could bring a lot of pressure.
Right.
It's easier sometimes if it's very unequal.
Yeah, right.
the chef is bringing a ton, but the front of the house is doing their job well.
Right.
And maybe the chef has influence on that. It's completely different when you've got two evenly powerful people in a relationship for that long.
Right.
Bringing all the gaze on them.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, but it's also natural. It's these things happen. And so I don't know if it's newsworthy, but
Of like if you consider, I mean, face it, most people aren't eating at 11 Madison Park. And, you know, it's quite expensive to eat there. It's very 1%-y sort of stuff. But so if you look at those kind of chefs as, you know, the artists, like it's different than the regular food world, right? They are sort of the artists of, you know, they are the elites of doing this craft, this art, food as art, food as this high level thing. So if you consider they're the Beyonce, they're the star, they're at the top of that game, you always are interested in the people who are doing the very highest expression of something. So that makes it newsworthy. It would be different if, you know, the restaurant wasn't that good or, you know, I mean, I don't think, you know, if, I mean, there are certain chefs who it's kind of fascinating, you know, and also they brought this on themselves to a degree in that they presented themselves in their social media feed and their interviews as this kind of thing, this couple, you know.
Well, I mean, I think they're projecting.
And it's a, you know, multi-million dollar deal going down, which, of course, I couldn't get the number. I'm sorry to say they wouldn't tell me. But, you know, it's.
Oh, there's all, they've got their fingers in a lot of
stuff. It is several million dollars
at
stake. So you could argue just from a business standpoint that it's an interesting story.
No, and.
Nomad, and he's opening. They're opening a restaurant in London.
In London,
they've got two Nomads, and I know LA. Yeah,
they've got the Nomad in Las Vegas.
Now, let me ask you this as a side note, if I may. Do you enjoy the 4-hour tasting meal like that you would get? Would you enjoy a meal at 11 Madison?
I've eaten at 11 Madison once in the last. I've eaten there 3 times, and the most recent time I went was probably my most enjoyable time. I just went and ordered a la carte at the bar.
Nice,
and it was great.
Right.
Food was amazing. They sent up, it's 11 Madison. Their reconnaissance
is good.
On the floor is very good.
You walk in, they would know exactly who you were.
Yeah. And they figured out who I was. And actually, I know Will very well.
Oh, great.
And I've known Daniel for a while. I don't know him well.
Okay,
but
so
I
what
know
do you
Will.
Know about Will? What was he saying to you?
Will
what
was
do
great.
You think?
Do
you think it was that Chris, the one theory, although I've heard this debunked, is that Christina was the Yoko Ono of the McCartney Lennon breakup.
See, I don't see that.
Yeah.
And
other people say that's complete
wonderful
bullshit.
Wonderful people. They both, I know they bought a place in more upstate New York recently. Yeah. And look, running at the speed that you have to run to operate a restaurant at the level of 11 Madison is not something you can do in perpetuity.
Right.
You will get exhausted and burnt
right.
out doing that
right.
year after year after right. year. I mean, going for 3 Michelin stars, going for top 50 every year is, I mean,
that's
it
a
drives
level of
people
excellence.
Like Bernard Loiseau in Burgundy
right.
to wander out with
right.
a shotgun and blow
right.
his head off.
Right.
I mean,
it's
it is pressure
crazy.
Laden.
Why
stuff.
Do chefs, why do people do that? Is it just
I
this
think
dry?
We are... Up and well, I think we still have the mantle of being the most criticized profession of anything. We get raked over the coals for everything, and it's all so subjective. Sometimes there's very good criticism, and you pull the good criticism out from an article or whatever it is. Bernie's great criticism. Frank Bernie writes brilliant reviews that are really insightful as to why he's giving it a good mark.
Mm-hmm.
Bad reviews are really good. You can always highlight like what they would need to change to be better.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately do that. But with the Yelp environment of the world, I think the pressure on chefs, mostly when you're buying in, when I brought Bernard Loiseau, that was because he lost a number of Michelin stars
right.
and couldn't really deal with it. And this is a very famous chef in Burgundy. And I think you personalize it. You personalize a Yelp review.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody gets on Yelp and has no idea that, you know, the chef here at Empire State South got in at 9 a.m. I don't require this, but, you know, got in at 9 a.m. and he'll leave at midnight. So for him to go home after a 13, 14, 15-hour day and have to read a 1-star review because somebody thought, oh, my God, this was awful. The pork belly was small. You know,
right.
And
the portions were the food was terrible and the portions were small.
Yeah. But often giving no real objective right. opinion as to what was wrong with the food. Like,
do you feel like Yelp is losing a little? I mean, we all now know, like, you know, somebody who's at a bad Yelp review. I'm like, I don't know who that person is. I mean, it's almost a parody now. Certainly I know Yelp reviews obviously can still hurt a business. But do you think people are savvy enough to kind of use Yelp more as a. Was a telephone directory in a way as opposed to a real? I mean, do you
but
use
it?
Do you
impact? No, but
if
I
you're
would,
in a town and
you know,
don't
okay.
know where to go eat, will
so
you look up Yelp?
So if I go to Pittsburgh and I'm starving and I'm by myself and I need to go get some food, I will open Google Maps and search restaurants. Up pops on all the things, pops a Google review and a star rating. that is definitely going to affect my decision on where
okay,
to go.
Okay, so it does have some power.
So they do have impact, and whether we like it or not. I do not go to Yelp ostensibly to find places where to eat.
Right.
But I do go for criticism and lists created by other people.
Right.
I have a lot of issues sometimes with coverage on Eater of various food topics.
Okay.
But I think they're doing a good job sometimes. But I think some of their lists and their Eater maps are very critical to how I travel and how I plan in advance.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's Eater's big strong suit. And having known Bill Addison, who was the national food writer for critic for them for a long time, and I know what he put into his lists, and I have to assume that the other people in the cities are equally as conscientious. And I think that's where they do, where Eater does a really good job. I'm not sure, you know, you can have arguments about how they deal with issues and all the other things when they're trying to do journalism is a little different thing. But I do think that that is those Eater Hot 38s or the Essential 38 restaurants is fantastic.
It's great. And they're really good with openings and things like that. And, you know,
that's definitely
they've got some
muscular
good fortes. And they've done some better long form pieces that I'm really interested in that have been really well done.
Every once in a while.
John Birdsall, the writer, brought
up. Oh, John's great. Yeah.
He's a great writer. He brought up on Twitter an interesting link to a really long article on the use of the term young guns.
Oh, right.
And
I
Eater
thought that
uses
was
it heavily,
fascinating.
But it was really fascinating to look at and kind of imploring them that maybe they should rethink the term.
Well, it's a very male term for one thing.
It's a very, very male
I mean, my guns
term.
Are, you know. And it's violent. And it's sort of like, I think, the way Christina rethought her crack pie, which I know people gave her a hard time with, but you know,
she relented for a long time on changing that, and she finally did, and did it in the right way.
It's, you know, you can argue, are you over PC, but I think there's a point at which, again, if restaurants and food are a cultural currency, we need to be, you know, think that where we lead, others will follow. So you need to kind of think through these
I
things.
Think you need to, I mean, and somebody else has written a lot about
or like addictive sauces. I always hate that. That's just bad writing, I think.
That is bad writing. Like, but, but also
like
how
heroin
name,
is addictive. The sauce is
how people
really
name
addictive.
Restaurants is really important and the history of it. Like, I had to do a lot of due
tell
diligence.
Me, tell us
on
a little
this.
Bit about your Empire State South.
Well, Empire State South is a really interesting name because after the Civil War, basically the government within Georgia created a council with marketing executives and economists to sort of drive this idea of Atlanta and Georgia would be the capital of the new South coming up.
Right.
And it was the tagline was it was going to be the Empire State of the South.
Right.
And so I just cinched it.
I liked
and
it.
Created
That's Kate. A great name.
And everybody's always like, oh, is it meant to evoke like a New York style restaurant? I'm like, no, it's just a restaurant of like where people
That's a fantastic name. It's a fantastic name.
Yeah. Right. But,
and in the South, you know, the things that we sort of assumed were sort of fine names, we're starting to really understand the history of them in ways that we haven't before. And really, you know, I mean, as you know, we're struggling with our Confederate past down here and the Confederate statues. And all of that is, I think, getting torn down in new ways, rightfully so, and thank God. But it's you have to be tricky with what you call things down
look,
here.
Yeah, I mean, look, we live in a very multicultural area in Atlanta, and you have to have empathy and understanding of all the situations and the backgrounds before you go naming something namby-pamby because it just doesn't work.
Right.
I mean, you've got to be smart about it.
Right. Well, Spiller Park, tell us about that, too.
Spiller Park was...
For all of your listeners who don't understand, if you want to get the best cup of coffee in Atlanta...
Named by Dale Donchi, my business partner at Spiller Park, which is a coffee shop. And it was the old baseball stadium on Ponce de Leon Avenue, that was an amazingly interesting baseball park right on Ponce, right in the middle of the city. And it was kind of a triple-A team called the Atlanta Crackers.
Right.
But it was a segregationist. It was all white baseball team. Now there were the Atlanta Black Crackers as well,
right?
And eventually the Atlanta Crackers became an integrated team,
right?
But you know, this was but it's a really historied, interesting story of that.
But
stadium.
Also the Negro League played at Spiller Park sometimes,
yep, they did.
And so you sort of saw the integration of the history of baseball, and as messy as that was, come through Spiller Park in a way. So I love the name. for the history. And it is tricky history, you know?
It is tricky history. It's always difficult. I'm looking at another article that you wrote, which was a really long-form piece and had a lot of other graphing and interesting stuff in the actual layout in the newspaper, which is From Apples to Popcorn, Climate Change is Altering Foods, America Grows. So tell me about this article.
Well, we we have a big climate change team. And
don't have climate change teams. They don't believe in it.
Right. Well, that's the New York Times does believe in climate change. We feel that it is, in fact, true. just call us crazy.
Who would have thunk?
And as happens in the food section, this is what Sam is great at, is often people will be like, well, I eat. I want to write about food. It's kind of like me saying, I go to the movies. I should be the movie critic. Well, really, there's a lot of intricacies around food. It's like a specialty beat, right? But the climate team wanted to write about food and climate change, and they wanted to write, and they did. So we decided to team up with them, and this was part of a package of work we did with them. And some of the ideas, they were like, well, you know, we stopped eating so much meat, and it would reduce carbon, blah, 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 and all of our foreheads hit the table because we're like, I don't think our food, people who are into food don't want to read about, you know, cows cause gas, and you know. So we were trying to come up with ways to do creative stories about food with the climate team, and we all took different assignments. And so I just thought, I kept hearing about small farms or crops that were just like really having a hard time. And I thought, why don't we just take individual little crops and just tell a couple stories about that around the country? And they did a big graphic around this. But like the sour cherry growers in northern Michigan are getting creamed because the ice, Lake Superior isn't freezing over long enough or hard enough. And that's what kept pests away for a long enough period of time and kept the flower, the buds happening at exactly the right time. And so what happens is if it's not cool enough, there's not enough chill hours, they're not getting enough cherries, but also the pests are coming in earlier and they're just getting decimated. And there's only like 450 families that still grow sour cherries up in northern Michigan. And, you know, you've got a whole culture built on the Michigan pie cherries. So that story, or in Washington State where you've got, which grows more organic apples than anywhere else in the country, but all their apples are getting sunburned. So they're having to, because it's hotter, so they've had to figure out this weird kind of netting to put over the groves to keep the sun from sunburning their apples. You know, so there's all these weird little changes and, you know,
they're not adding up to be little changes. They're adding up to be a wholesale,
you know. But then there's some, they're able to grow golden kiwi in Texas now, and they're going to try to get golden kiwis to be a Texas crop. And, you know, farmers are so adaptive, right? But the problem is it takes 10, 15 years to create, to breed out a plant that'll relate to a certain climate and pest situation, right? So the old land grant universities and all the federal funding to like figure out a cherry that can now grow in a little bit warmer weather, it takes 5 to 10 years for that to happen. Meanwhile, the farmers are going to go out of business, and we're cutting funding to all of those land grant universities. So it's a really kind of a tough, it is a mess. So anyway, that's what that story was about. And I was just kind of interested and just started calling around and talking to different people. And
it's really interesting, but it's interesting how crops become popular and change. Like Georgia never used to grow blueberries. Now Georgia is the largest producer of blueberries in the entire country.
Isn't that fantastic?
It's just weird. I've never associated blueberries with Georgia.
No, it's not those Georgia blueberries, but they're good.
And it's a lot of old tobacco and cotton land that has now been replanted with blueberries.
Do you have like a blueberry? Well, here, like, do you have a couple, or are you just kind of rely on some of the farmers market guys?
Yeah, we've got a lot of blueberry growers around Athens, so we got a ton around there.
I haven't noticed. I mean, I've had good Georgia blueberries and bad ones, but I have not noticed that there's like, you know, with peaches, like you can really drill down into a good peach, you know, but blueberries seem pretty the same across the board. Am I
think
missing
it's basically
it?
One blueberry
one
type
kind.
That we all grow.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that much about varietals
maybe you
of blueberries.
Would, you know, reveal some blueberry
but
secret on
the peaches are
show.
Funny. This is a really good peach season.
Oh my God! It's been the best,
and it's best time right now because
we had the best peaches this year.
Free stone peaches, I luckily they're back to what I perceive as being the best peaches around. Because otherwise, I had a peach in Colorado a couple of years ago. I was in Aspen for something that was phenomenal. Yeah. I was like blown away. It was like one of those Palisades peaches. It was so good.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. Just
and, you
like,
know, there's some good peaches in California, too.
Yeah,
agree,
they're
but
great.
The thing is, I feel
frog
like they
Olive.
Don't. Yeah, those frog. One of the best things I ever had was just like a peach on a. I had this classic,
peach on a plate for $12 at Chez Panisse.
I was in a field with Alice Waters. It was even better. In a peach orchard. I'm like, I'm that douchey food writer.
Hey,
I had that experience.
The more I look back at restaurants that I admire and want to be, the more I fall in love with Chez Panisse every
right.
day. And
right.
To me, it's so timeless and so beautiful
yeah.
because it is hitting constantly and has since its inception on the one thing that I find the most elusive and nuanced in food, which is a reverence of simplicity and technical approach to simplicity that's beautiful.
Right. Right. Thank you. And I want to eat everything. Every time I eat there, I want to eat everything.
It's just food.
That
you want to
eat. I'm very
eat.
Happy.
It's
yeah.
just like, what?
Now,
you
interesting,
want?
You know, the new food critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, Salejo did not put it on their Bay Area Top 100 this year. And she kind of did a little bit of a takedown of Chez Panisse. I think it was, you know, the young kid coming in wanting to, you know, just change. So it was interesting. I was wondering, I don't know if you read her review.
It's like
I
going
know,
to prison, punching out the big guy.
I think that maybe.
Right off the gate, you
there
just get
you
in
go.
There and
I think
you
that
go
was
after
it.
Him like
even
crazy.
Even you're going to get creamed later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. That's a good way to put it. I hadn't thought about that.
Sometimes you just got to do what
Gen
you got to do.
Gen pop, man. It's rough out there.
I evidently have watched too many shitty movies
yeah,
in my
exactly.
life. But yeah,
that's
I don't
is.
Know if it really
you're
works
like, you're
that
in
way.
Gen pop now. So, but it is true. So there are good peaches. But the thing is with Georgia peaches and South Carolina peaches, I have discovered, I think it's just the sun. It's that long, hot nights and sun that allows those sugars to happen in a way that just doesn't happen in other parts of the country. There's just
global
something
warming,
about that.
Good for peaches.
Yeah, there you go. In
really
fact, that guy,
good for
I remember,
peaches.
I was talking to this peach girl once, and I'm like, so selling peaches, what's that about? How does that work? And he goes, you know, with peaches, because they're so perishable. And they're so, he goes, I'm basically holding out an ice cube to you and asking you how much you'll pay for it as it melts in my hand. And I was like, that is a way to look at selling peaches.
Yeah. I'm looking at it. I pulled out an old cookbook. And some of these, there's a good connection to the New York Times in them. But, they're written by Raymond Sokolov, who was in his day. He was kind of the Sifty of his time.
In a way, yes, he was.
And but these are great old cookbooks that the Times put together. This one's called Great Recipes. That one's just written by Sokolov without the Times. But I'm just always interested in how recipes are written now as to how they used to be written.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be making a fricassee de volaille right mm-hmm. now, but maybe we would, but we just call it something different.
I like
a fricassee
that you
de
said
volaille
it.
Is, you know, it's a fowl stew.
Okay.
Let's call it that.
Okay.
This one's got duck in it.
Can you put it on a sheet pan? Because apparently that's what we're supposed to do now. Okay.
Oh, yeah, or in an Instant Pot. That's what we're supposed to do now. Do you do the Instant Pot?
You know what I do it for is stocks and broths. That's the only thing I use it for because it cuts the time for me a little
bit. It does, but the pressure cooker does that too.
Yeah, but
I don't that's
have
what, essentially
a pressure
what
cooker.
It is. Well, you do. You have an Instant
that's what
Pot.
I do. Honestly, I thought I could do rice in it because I'm like famous for my inability to make rice, and I have tried and tried and tried all the ways to make rice. And then said, oh, your Instant Pot, you'll make rice. But it's too much. It's a headache to pull it out. But if I get a bunch of old beef bones and roast them off, and I use it just basically, I use it as a fancy pressure cooker.
Is Melissa Clark half Instant Pot cyborg now?
You know, Melissa Clark, I think, is a good working food journalist and thought, I'm going to see what I can do with the Instant Pot. I don't
she really did a lot with the Instant Pot.
She did. Who knew? Well, you know the slow cooker.
I know the slow cooker.
Okay,
Melissa
slow,
knows the Instant Pot.
You now is a slow, because you have a whole, you did a whole book, Slow Cooker
I've got a
expert.
Whole thing. Yeah.
Slow cooker versus Instant Pot. Where are you in that?
I like the Instant Pot. The Instant Pot's kind of like Betamax-y to me. I think it'll go away. Maybe it's
right.
even superior technology. It just seems kind of gimmicky.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you're right. It is a pressure cooker.
And I don't like absurdly pre-programmed functioning on things. I just like low, medium, high.
Yeah.
Because I know how to cook.
Right.
I don't like pressing a button that says rice.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
like turning things on and cooking. Rice.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I
that's maybe different. Like, a lot of people
no,
like
I
that
think
push
it takes a lot to fool around and learn how to. That's why I don't. It's like I say, like, I think it's great. A pressure cooker would have been fine for my beef stock, I'm sure. So
now, one really interesting thing in the Times written from a food perspective that I don't think really was meant to be was the guy who started doing food delivery for one of the companies.
Oh, that was fantastic.
And it really blew
business
apart
story.
Because he really showed that basically, this company was taking all the tips that were ostensibly from the customer's perspective destined for the pockets of the person to deliver the food. They weren't going there. They were going into the company coffers and being redistributed amongst the employees some way, but not in full fulfillment.
Right. Now, I have to...
But that...
That was a great food story. That was a business. He just got on the bike and he became a delivery guy. And the way he described it was perfect because you got like, okay, I have to choose. Am I going to grab the Grubhub or am I going to hope that Uber Eats is going to give me a better deal? Is it going to be closer to where my bicycle is? And, you know, you got to see all the calculations that had to happen for the guy to make money. And so a certain thing would pop up and say, you're going to get $6.65 for this trip to go deliver this food, and you get there and the person adds the tip onto the app, and the rider still only gets $6.65 because the money goes somewhere else. So it was a good lesson, always tip in cash for the driver. But they also changed that policy then.
They did soon thereafter. They
that's
got so
the power
much
of journalism
flack, and that is the power of journalism.
But let me ask you this, isn't that sort of like what restaurants do with tips? I still want to understand the pooling tip sitch, because I'm very confused how that works.
Well, within Georgia, you really all the tips go to direct members who have contact of the team, who have direct contact with guests.
Okay,
delivering food and delivering beverage.
Okay,
that's where the pool tips go. That's okay. Ostensibly where they have to go. Kitchen pooling does not occur in Georgia usually.
Okay,
and under no auspices is any management or ownership ever allowed to take any portion of a tip.
Okay.
And that's been the really historic fraud within the restaurant sphere. You know, restaurants are just so full of dread and exploitation, unfortunately.
Right.
That's one of the ways that people were ripping people off.
So do you feel it's happening a lot? I mean, we see a lot of suits, and I think the Bastianich Empire got hit with a hard one for of this.
Yep.
And so what were they doing? I mean, is that common practice or were they?
They were
the
tip pooling. To the best of my knowledge, they were tip pooling and paying managers the large amounts out of that tip pool, which is.
There you go.
No.
Will tipping ever go away in this country?
I don't think so. I think we've had a lot of people go down the road of attempting gratuity included, and I think a lot of them have changed course and reverted to regular gratuity systems. The way I put it is this. I like the gratuity included when I'm a customer. It's a surprise to me. It's interesting. From a waiter's perspective, I used to have a waiter named Paul, and Paul was a great human and is still a great human. He just doesn't work for me anymore, but he did work for me at 5 and 10 for like 16 years. Well, Paul had nurtured relationships with some of the regulars there to the degree that they requested him every time. They wanted him. They tipped him really well. Does that work that Paul put into that relationship over time that expanded even outside of work with these people, but warranted granted him a large amount of tips from it? Don't you think he deserves that?
Yeah, I do.
So I don't know if it should.
And as a customer, I want my money to go to him.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And that, I think, needs to be taken into account, that we should be honoring the customer's request. Exactly like the DoorDash stuff, the customer's expectation was that delivery driver would get that money.
Right.
And that's key in the relationship with a gratuity,
right.
I think.
Because you feel like such a schmuck sitting there in the rain making some guy ride his bike or her bike to you to give you food that you want to, like, it helps you to feel less guilty. Like, buddy, I'm giving you $5.
This is real. I think there's a story there on how the Seamless and all those services, Uber Eats, all that, how are they affecting restaurant business?
Yeah. Well, aren't restaurants setting up? I mean, they're setting up places just for, I mean, you've got to build in like an Uber Eats stand now, right?
Right. But, you know, a $10 Uber Eats meal delivered to your door, Uber Eats takes 31% to 37%
of it. That big?
I mean, that's untenable for me to cook food of any sort of value or goodness.
Do you think it'll last?
I don't know. I fear that all of these things are built on speed and mass efficiencies and deviate so far from quality concerns that it'll just become about button sustenance.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that restaurants hopefully will feel strong enough that they don't have to feel like they need to do it. I think right now everybody feels like they have to do it, and they don't.
Secretly, I do one meal that's delivered by Seamless.
Do you? What's
no,
that?
I'm
like, I have no
idea. Molded Jello thing.
Nice.
With prizes in it.
See, that's special. That's because you're ahead of the crew. You're thinking.
Nobody buys it.
Do you do much you don't do
we don't
do here.
Any we don't do any of it. And you know, we'd buy into it later on, but it'd be probably a separate facility or something like that that can do it. But I just don't think, to me, that type of thing is, it's about feeding people, but it's so far away from what I love about this business.
Right.
I don't know if I can ever really adopt to it.
Right. And are you working, did you just tell me you're working on a new cookbook?
I'm working on a book, right now.
Pivoting over to recipes again.
How to make kids cook well, like leaving college or leaving to go to college. So kind of built on the premise of if you've got, I always say in cooking lessons that cooking's like, you bore it down to the idea of a Lego set, and each piece of Lego is a technique and a skill that you have. I just have a bigger set than most people.
I see.
But I want to give people a set of 24 blocks that then they can build a really good, nourishing way of cooking.
So, like, I know how to saute.
How to poach an egg. You know how to saute
I know how to make
roasted
vinaigrette.
Chicken.
Yeah.
Yep. How to roast
steam
a carrot.
Steam some vegetables
make,
or whatever.
You know, make the basic sauce and make mayonnaise and salsa verde and things like that.
And then you can have your flank steak and your salsa verde, or you could have your eggs and your salsa verde.
Or you can have a poached egg and put it on anything.
Right.
Because that's what we did back in 2005. I think we're over that time now.
You think?
I think we're like it again. I think we like the poached egg again.
I know. Well, you. I think the poached eggs are coming back.
I think they're coming back.
You heard it here first.
I know how to do them, too.
Yeah.
So I feel lucky.
Do you do that? I'm sorry. One last question before we go. Do you do the spin the water for the poached egg? Okay, do the swirl, but no vinegar. That's silly.
I do.
You do the little vinegar.
Okay. I do a little bit, and the reason that is it's a chemical reaction which causes the egg white to want to adhere to itself.
Okay.
But I do season towards the very end of the cooking process.
Okay.
It goes into virtually unsaline water at the beginning.
Okay.
But the swirl's key.
Swirl and just a kiss of vinegar.
But also, I find cracking the egg into a ramekin before pouring it in is key.
Helps it. Yeah, I think that's true. I was just wondering if the vinegar is going to make my egg taste a little vinegary, but I just have to be a little restrained.
I love vinegar.
Okay.
I love oeuf moret.
Oeuf moret, yes.
Cooked in,
delicious.
Wine. So good.
All right. Thank you for that tip. I just wanted to leave with one good.
Kim, you are an inspiration. You're an awesome journalist, and thank you for being on this dorky show I have.
It's a fantastic show, and I think everybody should listen to it. And I love sitting here in your restaurant. It reminds me that I've got to come back for dinner soon.
We're in the Pecky Cypress corner. It's quiet. Kim, off to a good day.
Yep. Thanks.